You're listening to continuing coverage in the Las Vegas Reporter murder trial of Robert Telles from the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today. Now, back to the courtroom.
We approach, Your Honor?
Sure.
Thank you.
All rise for entry, jury, please, jurors.
Gentlemen, does the state stipulate to the presence of the panel?
Yes, Your Honor.
And the defense?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, at this time, ladies and gentlemen, I am going to instruct you on the law. Officer Hawks is handing out the jury instructions. Each of you will have a copy of the instructions. You'll be able to take them with you when you go back to deliberate upon your verdict. It is now my duty as judge to instruct you in the law that applies to this case. It's your duty as jurors to follow these instructions and to apply the rules of law, the facts as you find them from the evidence. You must not be concerned with the wisdom of any rule of law stated in these instructions. Regardless of any opinion you may have as to what the law ought to be, it would be a violation of your oath to base a verdict upon any other view of the law than that given in the instructions of the court. Instruction number two, offend these instructions. Any rule, direction, ideas repeated or stated in different ways, no emphasis thereon is intended by me, and none may be inferred by you. For that reason, you are not to single out any certain sentence or any individual point or instruction and ignore the others, but you are to consider all the instructions as a whole and regard each in the light of all the others. The order in which the instructions are given has no significance as to their relative importance. Number three, an indictment is but a formal method of accusing a person of a crime and is not of itself any evidence of his guilt. In this case, it is charged an indictment that on or about the second day of September 2022 within the County of Clark, State of Nevada, contrary to the form, force, and effect of statutes in such cases made and provided, and against the peace and dignity of the State of Nevada, the defendant committed the crime of murder with use of a deadly weapon, victim 60 years of age or older, as follows. Did willfully, unlawfully, with malice aforethought, kill Jeffrey Gehrman, who was 60 years of age or older, with use of a deadly weapon, to wit, a knife, by stabbing the said Jeffrey Gehrman multiple times about the body, the said killing having been one, willful, deliberate, and premeditated, and or two, perpetrated by lying in wait for the said Jeffrey Gehrman, and or three, perpetrated by abuse of an older person. It is the duty of the jury to apply the rules of law contained in these instructions to the facts of the case and determine whether or not the defendant is guilty of the offense charged. Number four, murder is the unlawful killing of a human being with malice aforethought, either expressed or implied. The unlawful killing may be effected by any of the various means by which death may be occasioned. Number five, malice aforethought means the intentional doing of a wrongful act without legal cause or excuse or what the law considers adequate provocation. The condition of mind described as malice aforethought may arise from anger, hatred, revenge, or from particular ill will, spite, or grudge toward the person killed. It may also arise from an unjustifiable or unlawful motive or purpose to injure another, proceeding from a heart fatally bent on mischief or with reckless disregard of consequences and social duty. Malice aforethought does not imply deliberation or the lapse of any considerable time between the malicious intention to injure another and the actual execution of the intent, but denotes an unlawful purpose and design as opposed to accident and mischance. Number six, express malice is that deliberate intention unlawfully to take away the life of a human being, which is manifested by external circumstances capable of proof. Malice may be implied when no considerable provocation appears or when all of the circumstances of the killing show an abandoned and malignant heart. Number seven, the indictment alleges alternative theories of murder of the first degree, as allowed by law, in addition to willful, deliberate, premeditated murder, the indictment alleges the defendant committed the murder by means of lying in wait and or by abuse of an older person. Number eight, one theory of murder of the first degree is murder which is perpetrated by means of any kind of willful, deliberate, and premeditated killing. All three elements, willfulness, deliberation, and premeditation, must be proven beyond a reasonable doubt before an accused can be convicted of first-degree murder under the theory of liability. Number nine, willfulness is the intention to kill. There need be no appreciable space of time between formation of the intent to kill and the act of killing. Number 10, deliberation is the process of determining upon a course of action to kill as a result of thought, including weighing the reasons for and against the action and considering the consequences of the actions. A deliberate determination may be arrived at in a short period of time, but in all cases, the determination must not be formed in passion, or if formed in passion, it must be carried out after there has been time for the passion to subside and deliberation to occur. A mere unconsidered and rash impulse is not deliberate, even though it includes the intent to kill. Number 11, premeditation is a design, a determination to kill distinctly formed in the mind by the time of the killing. Premeditation need not be for a day, an hour, or even a minute. It may be as instantaneous as successive thoughts of the mind. For if the jury believes from the evidence that the act constituting the killing has been preceded by and has been the result of premeditation, no matter how rapidly the act follows the premeditation, it is premeditated. Number 12, the law does not undertake to measure in units of time the length of the period during which the thought must be pondered before it can ripen into an intent to kill, which is truly deliberate and premeditated. The time will vary with different individuals and under varying circumstances. The true test is not the duration of time, but rather the extent of the reflection. A cold, calculated judgment and decision may be arrived at in a short period of time, but a mere unconsidered and rash impulse, even though it includes an intent to kill, is not deliberation and premeditation, as will fix an unlawful killing as murder of the first degree. Number 13, another theory of murder of the first degree is murder perpetrated by means of lying in wait. The elements necessary to constitute lying in wait are watching, waiting, and concealment from the person killed with the intention of inflicting serious bodily injury upon such person or of killing such person. Nothing requires that the lying in wait exist for or consume any particular period of time before the act which causes the death. It is only necessary that the act causing death be preceded by and the outgrowth of lying in wait. Where a killing is accomplished after lying in wait, the state is not required to prove premeditation or deliberation. The killing constitutes murder of the first degree so long as it was committed with malice, either expressed or implied. Number 14, another theory of murder of the first degree is a kind of murder which carries with it conclusive evidence of malice aforethought. One of these classes of murder is murder committed in the perpetration or attempted perpetration of abuse of an older person. Therefore, a killing which is committed in the perpetration or attempted perpetration of abuse of an older person is deemed to be murder of the first degree, whether the killing was intentional or unintentional or accidental. This is called the felony murder rule. The intent to perpetrate or attempt to perpetrate abuse of an older person must be proven beyond a reasonable doubt. Number 15, any person who abuses an older person is guilty of abuse of an older person. Abuse means willfully causing unjustifiably pain or injury or mental suffering to an older person. An older person is defined in Nevada as 60 years of age or older. Number 16, although your verdict must be unanimous as to the charge, you do not have to agree on the theory of guilt or liability. Therefore, even if you cannot agree on whether the facts establish the defendant is guilty of willful, deliberate, and premeditated murder, murder by means of lying in wait, or felony murder by means of abuse of an older person, so long as all of you agree that the evidence establishes the defendant's guilt of murder in the first degree, your verdict shall be murder of the first degree. Number 17, all murder which is not murder of the first degree is murder of the second degree. Murder of the second degree is murder with malice aforethought, but without the admixture of premeditation and deliberation, nor by means of lying in wait or by means of elder abuse. Number 18, you are instructed that if you find the state is established that the defendant has committed first degree murder, you shall select First-degree murder is your verdict. The crime of first-degree murder includes the crime of second-degree murder. You may find the defendant guilty of second-degree murder if, one, you have not found beyond a reasonable doubt that the defendant is guilty of murder of the first degree, and two, all 12 of you are convinced beyond a reasonable doubt the defendant is guilty of the crime of second-degree murder. If you are convinced beyond a reasonable doubt that the crime of murder has been committed by the defendant, but you have a reasonable doubt whether such murder was of the first or of the second degree, you must give the defendant the benefit of that doubt and return a verdict of murder of the second degree. Number 19, you are instructed that if you find the defendant guilty of first or second degree murder, you must also determine whether or not a deadly weapon was used in the commission of the crime. If you find beyond a reasonable doubt that a deadly weapon was used in the commission of such an offense, then you shall return the appropriate guilty verdict reflecting with use of a deadly weapon. If, however, you find that a deadly weapon was not used in the commission of such an offense, but you find that it was committed, then you shall return the appropriate guilty verdict reflecting that a deadly weapon was not used. Number 20, deadly weapon means any instrument which, if used in the ordinary manner, contemplated by its design and construction, will or is likely to cause substantial bodily harm or death, or any weapon, device, instrument, material, or substance which, under the circumstances in which it is used, attempted to be used, or threatened to be used, is readily capable of causing substantial bodily harm or death. 21, the state is not required to have recovered the deadly weapon used in an alleged crime or to produce the deadly weapon in court at trial to establish that a deadly weapon was used in the commission of the crime. Number 22, in arriving at your verdict in this case as to whether the defendant is guilty or not guilty, the subject of penalty or punishment is not to be discussed or considered by you and should in no way influence your verdict. If your verdict is murder of the first degree, you will, at a later hearing, determine the issue of penalty or punishment. Number 23, to constitute the crime charge, it must exist a union or joint operation of an act forbidden by law and an intent to do the act. The intent with which an act is done is shown by the facts and circumstances surrounding the case. Do not confuse intent with motive. Motive is what prompts a person to act. Intent refers only to the state of mind with which the act is done. Motive is not an element of the crime charge, and the state is not required to prove a motive on the part of the defendant in order to convict. However, you may consider evidence of motive or lack of motive as a circumstance in the case. Number 24. The defendant is presumed innocent until the contrary is proved. This presumption places upon the state of Nevada the burden of proving beyond a reasonable doubt every element of the crime charge and that the defendant is the person who committed the offense. A reasonable doubt is one based on reason. It is not mere possible doubt, but is such a doubt as would govern or control a person in the more weighty affairs of life. If the minds of the jurors, after the entire comparison and consideration of all the evidence, are in such a condition that they can say they feel an abiding conviction of the truth of the charge, there is not a reasonable doubt. Doubt to be reasonable must be actual, not mere possibility or speculation. If you have a reasonable doubt as to the guilt of the defendant, he is entitled to a verdict of not guilty. Number 25, the evidence which you are to consider in this case consists of the testimony of the witnesses, the exhibits, and any facts admitted or agreed to by counsel. There are two types of evidence. Direct and circumstantial. Direct evidence is the testimony of a person who claims to have personal knowledge of the commission of the crime which has been charged, such as an eyewitness. Circumstantial evidence is the proof of a chain of facts and circumstances which tend to show whether the defendant is guilty or not guilty. The law makes no distinction between the way to be given either direct or circumstantial evidence. Therefore, all of the evidence in the case, including the circumstantial evidence, should be considered by you in arriving at your verdict. Statements, arguments, and opinions of counsel are not evidence in the case. However, if the attorney stipulates to the existence of a fact, you must accept the stipulation as evidence and regard that fact as proved. You must not speculate to be true any insinuations suggested by a question asked a witness. A question is not evidence and may be considered only as it supplies meaning to the answer. You must disregard any evidence to which an objection was sustained by the court and any evidence ordered stricken by the court. Anything you may have seen or heard outside the courtroom is not evidence and must also be disregarded. Number 26, in this trial, you heard evidence of other acts regarding the defendant, Mr. Tejas, and the articles written by Jeff Gehrman. You are not to conclude from this evidence the defendant is a person of bad character or is predisposed to commit crimes. Number 27, The credibility or believability of a witness should be determined by their manner upon the stand, their relationship to the parties, their fears, motives, interests, or feelings, their opportunity to have observed the matter to which they testified, the reasonableness of their statements, and the strength or weakness of their recollections. If you believe a witness has lied about any material fact in the case, you may disregard the entire testimony of that witness or any portion of their testimony which is not proved by other evidence. Number 28, witnesses who have special knowledge, skill, experience, training, or education, a particular subject, have testified to certain opinions. This type of witness is referred to as an expert witness. In determining what weight to give an opinion expressed by an expert witness, you should consider the qualifications and believability of the witness, the facts or materials upon which the opinion is based, and the reasons for each opinion. Opinion is only as good as the facts and reasons on which it is based. If you find that any fact has not been proven or has been disproved, you may consider that determining the value of the opinion. Likewise, you must consider the strength or weaknesses of the reasons on which it is based. You are not bound by any opinion. Give each opinion the weight you find it deserves. You may disregard any opinion if you find it to be unreasonable. Number 29, although you are to consider only the evidence in the case and reaching a verdict, you must bring to the consideration of the evidence your everyday common sense and judgment as reasonable men and women. Thus, you are not limited solely to what you see and hear as the witnesses testify. You may draw reasonable inferences from the evidence which you feel are justified in the light of common experience, keeping in mind such inferences should not be based on speculation or guess. A verdict may never be influenced by sympathy, prejudice, or public opinion. Your decision should be the product of sincere judgment and sound discretion in accordance with these rules of law. Number 30, during your deliberations, you're not to communicate with anyone in any manner regarding the facts and circumstances of this case or its merits, either by phone, email, text, messaging, internet, or other means. You are admonished not to read, watch, or listen to any news or media accounts or commentary about the case. You're not permitted to do any independent research, such as consulting dictionaries, using the internet, or any other reference materials. You are further admonished not to conduct any investigation, test a theory of the case, recreate any aspects of the case, or in any other manner investigate or learn about the case on your own. Number 31, when you retire to consider your verdict, you must first select one of your members to act as foreperson who will preside over your deliberation and will be your spokesperson in court. During your deliberation, you will have all the exhibits admitted into evidence, these written instructions, and forms of verdict prepared for your convenience. Your verdict must be unanimous. As soon as you agree upon a verdict, the foreperson shall sign and date the verdict form and return with it to this room. Number 32. Now you will listen to the arguments of counsel, who will endeavor to aid you to reach a proper verdict by refreshing in your minds the evidence and by showing the application thereof to the law. But whatever counsel may say, you will bear in mind it is your duty to be governed in your deliberation by the evidence as you understand it and remember it to be, and by the laws given to you in these instructions, with the sole fixed and steadfast purpose of doing equal and exact justice between the defendant and the state of Nevada. The state may open and close the arguments.
Thank you, Your Honor. By June of 2022, Jeff Garriman had caused a lot of problems for the public administrator, Robert Tellis. He had written articles accusing Mr. Tellis of an inappropriate relationship. He had written that he was bullying in the office and had created a hostile environment in the public administrator's office. He had written an article saying that the management of Mr. Tellis was so bad that the county had to bring in a private consultant in order to assist with the management of an 8-person office. After Mr. Garriman wrote those articles, Mr. Tellis lost his primary race and would not be the public administrator after that. And not just that he lost the race, he lost the race to a rival within the public administrator's office itself. And from the text messages of Mr. Tellis, we learned that this was deeply, deeply troubling for him. He wrote to Mr. Gehrman, "I don't know what to say. I told you how much this all impacted me. You heard from employees who are being harassed by these people, provided you," I think this is a typo, "proof that I was doing my best to actually smooth things over. I had to make hard decisions. Still, you wrote an article that makes it sound like I'm the guilty one. That wasn't fair or balanced." He told Mr. Gehrman, "I'm distraught right now." Clearly, there are typos in my message. He told Mr. Gehrman that he was adding to the pressure of his life. "I've done so much for that office. I've told you that I've been followed and that I caught Rita following me. You decided to take it on her word that she wasn't. However, clearly she was. It seems to me that you valued sensationalism or the value of a potential takedown than actually telling the truth. Thank you for helping him drop more pressure on my life." Now, Mr. Gehrman's response was a response that you'd get probably from many reporters. He says, "Sorry you feel that way. My editors and I feel the story is fair and balanced." Mr. Tellis' response, "I don't know that you could truly feel that. You have concrete proof I provided you of what is really going on. You acknowledge much of it. You mention none of it. If telling yourself that you were fair helps you sleep at night while you're trying to destroy good people, that's your prerogative." And Mr. Tellis does attempt to fight back from these articles on his campaign website. He posts this letter discrediting the paper and discrediting the allegations in those articles written by Mr. Gehrman. He goes on Twitter and he accuses Mr. Gehrman of being a bully. He says Mr. Gehrman had threatened him. He told other people on social media in this first screenshot that, "Because of those articles, I had to increase my medication to cope with it all." He tells someone who reposted the article or sent it that he was deeply disappointed that they had done that. And he's generally following the fallout of those articles on social media. But the reality is he lost that primary election after those articles were written, and he attributed it to the articles written by Jeff Gehrman. He told his best employee, Nicole Lofton, "Unfortunately, too many people bought the lies." He told his best employee, Nicole Lofton, "I'm so sorry. I'm devastated that everything we worked for is going to be done. I hate them and what they did." And after all that happened and losing the primary, his concern was that another article might be coming. He explains, "I'm going to pull the trigger on the supervisory changes. I'm going to go with the original plan. I think if I do any more than that, they will say I'm interfering with operations." And then he added, "She is probably trying to get fodder to pass to the reporter." And he sent another text after that, that there's more garbage being gathered for a news article. And Mr. Tellis testified to you that after the primary took place, he actually half drafted, he didn't file it, a lawsuit where he was going to sue his rival, Rita Reed, and he was going to insinuate in that lawsuit, coincidentally, that there was a conspiracy that caused his problems in the election. If you look at point 21, he wrote, "Upon information and belief, several employees conspired to make false allegations of mistreatment by Mr. Tellis. These employees contacted the Las Vegas Review-Journal to share false and defamatory statements in support of news articles against Mr. Tellis." So he was clearly incredibly upset that those articles were written and that it resulted in him losing that primary. In July, Jeff Gehrman, though, isn't done with his stories and his examination of what is going on with Mr. Tellis and the public administrator's office. In July, he sends that request for the public records of the county, where he's asking for communication between Mr. Tellis and Roberta, and then ultimately it expands to other individuals in the county. But he wants all team messages between Mr. Tellis and Roberta. He wants cell phone messages. He wants essentially all of their communications as of July, and that's after those four articles were written. Mr. Tellis, of course, is informed by this, informed of this request by the county, and this occurs on August the 8th, and they explain, hey, look, this reporter's seeking all of this information. So the message underlying all of this is another article is forthcoming. Mr. Tellis messages back that he wants to review those communications prior to them being released to the reporter. But as of August 8th, he's on notice of another article coming. And if you look at this email, he responds, responds about 20 minutes after that first email was sent to him. Now, looking at the August calendar, you can see that on August the 8th, that's when he receives the notification of the public records request. And by August the 12th, there are images from Google Maps of Jeff Gehrman's neighborhood, Bronze Circle. We don't know the date they were created, but we know they were modified by August the 13th, meaning they had to be created sometime before that. Now, this doesn't mean that Mr. Tellis physically went to Bronze Circle on the days leading up to the modification date of the 13th. It simply means that he went and accessed Google Maps, and Bronze Circle is the area that was searched and accessed by his phone. And those images are, of course, where Jeff Gehrman lives. Now, the next date to keep in mind in our series of events in August of 22 is August the 15th. In August the 15th, that is when there's images of all of those cars that are kind of driving along the access road to Jeff Gehrman's neighborhood. Now, once again, we have a modification date. That doesn't mean that the images were all taken on the 15th, but they had to exist before the 15th to be modified on that date. And if you recall, Detective Gaddis figured out where this was, and it's right off of Mr. Gehrman's neighborhood. His house is right here on Bronze Circle, and she figured out by looking at the photographs where it was located in Las Vegas. And she figured out it was located right at this Popeye's parking lot, and that slanted wall ends up being in almost all of the images. And there are a lot of them, of several cars driving by the access road to Mr. Gehrman's house. So we have the notification on the 8th, we have accessing Google Maps on the 12th, we have those screenshots of all of those vehicles in conjunction with Mr. Gehrman's neighborhood by the 15th, and then by the 23rd, there have been searches of Mr. Gehrman's personal information on Mr. Tellis's computer. This is Mr. Tellis's work computer at his desk. If you look at the screen on the right, you can see like there's a bottle of hand sanitizer, kind of there's an arrow pointing to it. Here's a closer view. And the screenshots from his phone, you can see that the same cap to that bottle is in the screenshot as well. So these were clearly taken on his work computer while he was at work. And you can see that he's looking up personal information of Mr. Gehrman, the kind of car he drives. He ultimately is able to get the address of 7216 off his work computer. And once again, those photos were in existence by August the 23rd of 2022. So all of those events, the notification, the accessing of Bronze Circle on Google Maps, the screenshots of the car, and then using the work computer to access personal information of Jeff Gehrman, all occurs in August of 2022. Moving to September, that's when Mr. Tellis, on September the 1st, receives notification that the county is getting ready to release all of that, all of those documents that were subject to the public records request. He's notified, and Ms. Kennan is notified on September the 1st of 2022, and the murder's the very next day. It's about 15 hours later. Now, we know that on the morning of the 2nd, Mr. Tellis left his house and proceeded into the area of Mr. Garriman's neighborhood, and that he kind of meanders around there, but ultimately ends up on those cross streets and then proceeds on foot to Mr. Garriman's residence. Mr. Tellis's residence is at the top of the screen there on Spanish Steps. He goes down that Silk Tassel Road and then goes on Red Hills Road. And he leaves at 9:12 in the morning. Now, eventually, he's in the area of Rock Springs Drive, which is near Mr. Garriman's neighborhood. The time on that video is incorrect. It says 9:42 a.m. But you heard from Detective Mogg that the corrected time for that particular camera is 10:26. So he's in the area of Mr. Garriman's neighborhood at about 10:26 a.m. in the morning. What's the next thing that happens? Well, you know that this is Mrs. Tellis's Apple Watch, and she sends that message to Mr. Tellis at 10:35 a.m. You can kind of see it says Friday, 10:35 a.m. And the message is, where are you? Well, he's sitting in Mr. Garriman's neighborhood, so he's not answering this text message. That text message goes unanswered. Mr. Tellis at 10:40 a.m. is now on Wintergreen Drive, which is the cross street to Bronze Circle. He's on Wintergreen Drive at about 11 a.m. and the murder itself takes place at about 11:18 a.m. Then Mr. Tellis is back at his own neighborhood by 11:51 a.m. And this is video from that Piggott Elementary School, which Detective Mogg indicated that that timestamp is correct. And what does he do? He gets back at 11:51 a.m. and then he's able to get his BMW and proceed to Planet Fitness. So there's his BMW leaving. It's 12:03, and then you know from Detective Gaddis's testimony that it's about a 4 to 6 minute drive. He's able to be at Planet Fitness by 12:09. So by 9:03, which is now the day after the murder, it has been reported that Jeff Garriman has been murdered. And then Roberta, who's working, has heard about the murder, and she's starting to get concerned. She tells Mr. Tellis, I'm working tomorrow now. I don't want to be in the office alone. I'd rather be with the crazy women than alone right now. She's concerned about Mr. Garriman getting murdered, and she's scared about being in the office alone. By September 5th and 6th, the Las Vegas Metropolitan Police Department has released images of the assailant and also of the Yukon itself. And Roberta becomes even more concerned. She messages Mr. Tellis, Rob, WTF, please do not be driving your Yukon around for a while. This is on September the 6th. He answers, whoa, that's crazy. She says, please tell me your Yukon is not that color. He answers, it is similar, if not the same. She says, I'm freaking out, Rob. He answers, my car has all matching wheel patterns. I think they are saying that there's a difference between the front and the back of the assailant's vehicle. But Roberta looks at it and says, fuck, your car is identical. And it actually turns out that Roberta is the one that is correct. His car is identical. From that lighter spot on the passenger side, just below the windshield wiper, there's sort of like a lighter rectangular shaped portion of the car. You can see that in the video. From the differentiating tint between the front and the back of the vehicle, that part is identical. And from the wheels themselves, they weren't different. They were the same. The wheel rims on the front and the back are identical. It is his Yukon. He is the one who committed the murder. So let's talk about the charge of murder. Murder is the unlawful killing of a human being with malice aforethought, either expressed or implied. And all that means is an act of ill will. When you go back to deliberate, you'll be asked two overarching general questions about the crime. And those are, was a deadly weapon used in the commission of the crime? And was the victim of the crime 60 years of age or older? So as you heard from Judge Leavitt, a deadly weapon is simply an object capable of causing substantial bodily harm or death. We obviously have that in this case. The knife wounds inflicted on Mr. Gehrman were definitely not caused by human hands, and they were capable of causing substantial bodily harm or death, because that's ultimately what happened. You may be asking, well, where is it? Like, that knife didn't come to court. But the instructions tell you that the state is not required to have recovered a deadly weapon used in an alleged crime or to produce it at trial. You just have to be able to gather from the evidence that a deadly weapon was used. Obviously, the injuries of Mr. Gehrman indicate that this was not caused by human hands. A deadly weapon was used to accomplish his murder. So that overarching question about the crime is probably an easy one to answer. Probably the easiest one after that is, was Mr. Gehrman over 60 years old at the time the crime occurred? And he was 69 years old at the time it occurred. So let's talk about first degree murder. As Judge Leavitt explained to you, there are three theories, three pathways that you can reach a verdict of first degree murder. The first one is a willful, deliberate, and premeditated murder. The second one is murder perpetrated by means of lying in wait. And the third one is murder perpetrated during the course of elder abuse. Now, the first form of first-degree murder is probably the one you're the most familiar with, and that is a murder that is willful, deliberate, and premeditated. And you'd have to find all of those elements in order to find Mr. Tellis guilty under that theory of first-degree murder. So let's talk about what each of these mean. Willfulness is very simple. It's simply an intent to kill. Do your actions demonstrate an intent to kill? So this part of the video takes about 2 minutes. The entire time of that 2 minutes, Mr. Tellis is attacking Mr. Gehrman with a weapon. So that demonstrates an intent to kill. He's stabbing him repeatedly. Mr. Gehrman is clearly trying to fight back, but Mr. Tellis doesn't stop. It keeps going and going and going. And it's kind of a long time to be inflicting injuries on another individual. He finally walks out on the side. Yeah. But the duration of that time, the entire time, Mr. Gehrman is being attacked. So let's talk about deliberation, which is the second element. Deliberation is determining upon a course of action to kill as a result of thought, including weighing the reasons for and against the action. Well, what do we know about Mr. Tellis's actions prior to the murder? Well, we know back in August, when he got notification that another story was likely coming, he kind of goes into research mode on Mr. Gehrman, where he's located, what kind of car he might be driving, searches on his computer. All of that demonstrates deliberation. Even if you didn't have all of these actions back in August, the length of time of the actual attack itself is sort of a shorter version demonstrating a course of action to kill, right? In the course of 2 minutes, you are stabbing someone multiple times, you could change your mind, but he doesn't do that. He keeps going and going and going, not even withstanding all this pre-planning. Now, premeditation is the last element of that first theory of first degree murder, and that is simply a decision to kill before you do it. Before you came in and sat as jurors, you may have thought that premeditation is always a case of pre-planning and months in advance and that sort of thing. And that is definitely a case of first-degree murder and kind of exactly what we have in this case. But you're told by the instruction that premeditation need not be for a day, an hour, or even a minute. It can be as instantaneous as successive thoughts of the mind. So what that instruction tells you is, in the law of Nevada, for premeditation, if I make a decision to kill you and I do it a month from now, that's premeditation. If I make a decision to kill and I do it a week from now, that's premeditation. If I do it an hour later, it's premeditation. If I do it a minute later, it's premeditation. If I do it a second later, it's still premeditation. And you have a video of the attack on Mr. Gehrman, and clearly there's a decision made to kill him. But beyond that, you also know that Mr. Tellis took the step of leaving his phone at home prior to the murder. That's indication of premeditation and planning. You know that he bothered to disguise himself by wearing the hat and the orange outfit. That shows premeditation, a decision to kill. And you also know, most of all, that he brought a weapon over to Mr. Gehrman's house, and that shows premeditation as well. So that theory of first-degree murder has been established in this case. Let's talk about the second theory of first-degree murder, which is murder perpetrated by means of lying in wait. And the instructions explain what that is. Another theory of first-degree murder is murder perpetrated by means of lying in wait. And what that is kind of taking on a place of concealment in order to inflict injury or death upon another person. It's sort of the second paragraph, it says, watching, waiting, and concealment from the person killed with the intention of inflicting serious bodily harm upon or serious bodily injury upon such person or of killing such a person. And in this case, you actually see the actions of Mr. Tellis literally lying in wait. He goes into Mr. Gehrman's yard and recedes to the back in order to be in a place of concealment in order to attack him later on. And that is literally lying in wait. So that theory of first-degree murder is established as well. The third theory of first-degree murder is murder occurring during the perpetration of abuse of an older person. And this is kind of like like child abuse, where if you abuse a child and a child happens to die in the course of abuse, it's automatically first-degree murder. The same is true for individuals who are over 60. If you abuse an older person and they die during the course of that abuse, that is an automatic case of first-degree murder. And it's sort of a policy judgment to protect vulnerable members of our society. The instructions tell you another theory of first-degree murder is a kind of murder which carries with it conclusive evidence of malice aforethought. One of these classes of murder is murder committed in the perpetration or attempted perpetration of abuse of an older person. Therefore, a killing which is committed in the perpetration or attempted perpetration of an older person is deemed to be murder of the first degree, whether the killing was intentional, unintentional, or accidental. We have that in this case. Mr. Gehrman was over 60 years old, so by abusing him and causing his death, it is automatically another theory of first degree murder. So this is sort of this is a picture of the verdict form that you'll have back in your deliberation room, and you can kind of see on the top in all caps it says murder with use of a deadly weapon, victim 60 years of age or older. That was those very first two questions I discussed with you at the beginning of the closing that you would answer as jurors, and then as a jury you should ask about the individual theories of first degree murder and vote on them. So you have to vote if all 12 of you think that this was a willful, deliberate, and premeditated murder. Do all 12 of you find that it was perpetrated by means of lying in wait? Do all 12 of you agree that it was perpetrated in the course of abuse of an older person? If you find all of those, then you mark those boxes. If you are in disagreement, say only three of you think it was willful, deliberate, and premeditated, or some combination, you have to take a vote to decide if all of you believe that it's first-degree murder under some theory. And if it is, you mark that last box and say, we don't find unanimously under any of those three theories, but we all of us agree, 12 of us agree, that it's some form of first-degree murder. The law tells you, although your verdict must be unanimous as to charge, you do not have to agree on a theory of guilt or liability. So if all 12 of you agree one form of first-degree murder, then you mark that last box. But it's the state's position that all three of those theories, willful, deliberate, premeditated, lying in wait, and elder abuse, clearly apply in this case. And really, Mr. Tellis isn't disagreeing that this is a case of first-degree murder. He's just saying that it was a Compass Realty assassin who did it. Now here we see Mr. Tellis leaving his house at about 9:12 a.m., and it's the state's theory, of course, that at that point he's left his house and his cell phone is sitting back at his house on Spanish Steps. The state's theory is that Mr. Tellis leaves his residence, leaves the phone at the residence, and is proceeding to Mr. Gehrman's residence. And as we've discussed, the Yukon is seen at Rock Springs at about 10:26 a.m. Here's two different images of it. Meanwhile, Mr. Tellis's cell phone, which is sitting back at Spanish Steps, is getting some incoming messages. There's an incoming and unanswered message at about 9:44 a.m. about a work case. There's an incoming and unanswered message at about 10:16 about another case at his work. There's an incoming unanswered message from his wife saying, where are you, at 10:36 a.m. Now you'd think, given that some of the allegations in the articles, this might be one he'd answer pretty quickly. There's an unanswered incoming call from his wife at 10:43 a.m. that doesn't get answered by him. And there's another incoming call that occurs at 11:16 a.m. Meanwhile, you know, he is at Mr. Gehrman's house. So ask yourself this. If this was really a Compass Realty assassin who was committing the murder at Bronze Circle, how would that individual know that Mr. Tellis, with his phone at his house, wouldn't have answered a call, or wouldn't have gotten in another text string, or wouldn't have made a call himself? How could anybody but Mr. Tellis be the killer? No one would have that level of assurance, because if any of those calls had been answered from his house, it would be clear that he wasn't the one involved. Now we know from the video evidence from Bronze Circle that after the murder occurs, Mr. Tellis actually returns to Mr. Gehrman's house, and he goes to the side area of the yard where Mr. Gehrman is located. And then he returns back to the Yukon. And eventually does that U-turn and drives away. But if you're wondering why there isn't blood in the Yukon, he had to walk all the way out of that crime scene, and anything that had been deposited on his shoes would have come off in the rocks. Besides that, the crime scene itself is not drenched in blood on the ground. These are Mr. Garamond's shoes. There is some blood on them, but they're not exactly drenched, and he's the victim. So after Mr. Tellis leaves Bronze Circle for the second time, he goes east, he goes on Wintergreen, he goes on Washington, he goes on Rampart, he goes on Apple, and he goes back to his neighborhood at 1151, and then he leaves again to go to Planet Fitness at about 1203. You also know that Mr. Tellis is the killer because of the DNA evidence in this case. Remember how this comes into play. They collect the samples from the scene, and the Metro DNA analyst has this result of foreign DNA being present on September the 5th. They haven't even collected a DNA sample from Mr. Tellis until the 7th. So it's not like Metro or Compass Realty has a sample of Mr. Tellis' DNA to come insert in this crime scene. It's Mr. Tellis' DNA in this scene. It's literally on the body of Mr. Garamond. The items from the search warrant also tell you that Mr. Tellis is the person responsible for this crime. Those shoes that were found in the house, they weren't planted, they were hidden. They were cut up. Anyone who planted the shoes would have no reason to cut them up. The cutting up is to benefit Mr. Tellis so he can get rid of them. If you were just planting them, you could leave them alone. And they're clearly his shoes because, one, they're in his house. Two, his DNA is present on them. And if you don't believe that, there's pictures in his phone of those shoes on a day when he apparently went rock climbing. You have the bag that was located and ultimately the hat as well. And you heard a lot of testimony about how all of this evidence was collected from the scene. There's the detective who physically finds it, working with other detectives who are also doing the search. There's the detective that's assigned to be the scribe, to write down where everything is located. There's a crime scene analyst assigned to photograph it. In place. There's DNA analysts who actually analyze the physical evidence after the fact. And all of this occurred, this whole search occurred, while his wife is sitting in the house and aware of what they're doing. None of this evidence was planted. There's the bag, there's the hat, that was the location of the hat in his house. Finally, you know from the searches of the Bronze Circle where he accessed the Google Maps of Mr. Garamond's house that he is the one responsible. He's not friends with Mr. Garamond. He doesn't have business to do with Mr. Garamond. There is no reason for images of Bronze Circle to be in his phone prior to the murder occurring. You also know that he is the one responsible from the sort of amateur surveillance that occurred in August prior to the murder itself. There's no reason for any of this to be in his phone, but that he's attempting to gather information on Mr. Garamond. And finally, you know he actually used his work computer to gather information on Mr. Garamond as well. At the end of his testimony, I think yesterday, Mr. Tellis explained that, he's really a victim in this, you know. He's been victimized by the whole process. And he told you that He was wronged by his coworkers who didn't appreciate his changes that he made in the office and didn't appreciate his management style. He was wronged by the county who didn't understand that he was being a good leader. He was wronged by Zach Schilling, and by Kristen Riffle. He was wronged by them as well. He was certainly wronged, according to him, by Compass Realty. He was wronged by Steve Wolfson. He was wronged by the patrol officers who preserved that scene at Mr. Gehrman's house. He was wronged by Metro Police, in particular, Detective Gaddis and Detective Jappe. He was wronged by some mysterious, illusory phone hacker. He was wronged by DNA analysts at Metro who found his DNA on the fingernails of Mr. Gehrman. And then, of course, he was obviously wronged by Mr. Gehrman, too, in the articles he wrote. Or maybe it's not that he was wronged. Maybe he's the one in the wrong.
Very much. At this time, we're going to take a 10-minute recess. During this recess, you're admonished not to discuss or communicate with anyone, including your fellow jurors, in any way regarding the case or its merits, either by voice, phone, email, text, internet, or other means of communication or social media, or read, watch, or listen to any news or media accounts or commentary, do research, consult dictionaries, the internet, or reference materials, do any investigation, test a theory, recreate any aspect of the case, or in any other way investigate or learn about the case on your own, or former express any opinion regarding the case until it's finally submitted to you. We'll be in recess for 10 minutes.
Thank you. All rise. Next speaker,
more continuing coverage in the Las Vegas Reporter murder trial of Robert Tellez is on the way. From the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today, press subscribe now.